accession number 18507, Reel 1.
Mr. Napper, Reel 1. Mr. Napper, can you tell me something about your family background and when you were born?
I was born in 1916, during the Battle of Passchendaele, I believe. My father, who was at the war at the time, and my father was an artist who had been on the stage before the war, and then he and my mother married in 1914. Dad went off to the war. And then I was born in 1916, and then when my father came back, we lived in, well, we went to live for a very short time in Radlett, just in Middlesex, which was a delightful country village in those days. I don't, it's probably covered in skyscrapers now, but then it was nice. And then we left and came back to London, where we lived until my brother was born in 1920. And then in 1921, he got the terrible enteric bug. And we had to, the only way of saving his life, there were no penicillins or antibiotics in those days. And we were told that the only way to save his life would be to take him to live on the East Coast. Well, Dad, having just come back from the war and only just sort of starting as an artist, he had to get a job, and he got a job as an illustrator in a firm in Dundee in Scotland, which subsequently became D.C. Thompson. And we went up to Scotland, where we lived until, I suppose, 1925, I think. Then we came down to England again. And I was at school at St. Christopher's in Letchworth, and at Fensham Heights in Surrey. And then my father and mother and another, because my father and mother both taught at both St. Christopher and at Frensham Heights. And then they, in conjunction with one of the other teachers, they founded a school of their own down in Chichester. And we went down there, and then came the great crash of 1928. And that my poor father had to, everything was wiped out, and he had to go back to this firm in Scotland in Dundee, where he went on illustrating until he died in 1950. It was a sad thing, because he was a very, very good painter. He was a lovely watercolor artist, but because wife and three children, he had to make his living. It's one of the reasons why we have no children, because right from the beginning I decided that I was going to paint, and nothing was going to get in the way at all.
When did you decide you wanted to paint?
My father gave me my first lesson in painting on the day that my mother, I can remember it as though it were yesterday, my mother said, just after breakfast, she said to my father, I'm going to teach John to read and write this morning. She was a very brilliant teacher, actually. And Dad, who was a very jealous person, and I can see it now in my mind's eye, even though it's 80 years ago nearly, he stood up and said, well, if you do that, I'll teach him to put on a wash this afternoon. So that one day, and the two things that I love most in life, really, is writing and painting. And they both originated from that moment. And from that moment, I've really done nothing but paint, except for writing. I do write. I write in winter, when the light isn't good enough to paint by.
Do you feel that that painting can be taught, or is it a genuine talent?
I think it can be taught. I don't think it is taught, but I think it can be taught. But it can be taught by example. You see, in the days of the old masters, one would be apprenticed to a painter, and the goodness of that painter would come off onto you. And there would be this personal thing of working in a working condition, a working studio, painting pictures that would satisfy patrons, and the whole craft of it was a craft as much as anything else. Whereas where I think the real danger of painting came with the coming of the art school, because the art school is a totally unrealistic institution. And people aren't taught to paint there. They're encouraged perhaps to express themselves, which is all right, but it's not much good when you're in your teens. And they are also, of course, these days particularly, they're pushed into being dedicated followers of fashion, which has been one of the most disastrous things for painting in the last 2,000 years.
What about your education? How did that progress?
My education was, I started off at the Dundee School of Art, where I was taught by a very brilliant designer who'd been a pupil at the Bauhaus in Germany. His name was A.L. Russell. And he gave me a bit, whereas I got all my love and knowledge of painting from my father, this design master taught me the basis of the simplicity of design and the originality of design. A very inspiring person. And then when I left the Dundee School of Art, I went to the Royal Academy Schools, behind Burlington House, and I was taught to draw by Tom Monnington, who was a marvellous draftsman, not a wonderful painter, but a very nice man and a wonderful draftsman. He taught me to draw. Painting I've had to learn myself, and I didn't like what was going on around me. What people were called painting seemed to be so much sort of pushing bits of dirt around on the canvas. And it wasn't until we got fed up and went to live in France in 1956. And we lived in France for 14 years, and during that time I learned a lot about oil paint.
Do you have a preferred medium that you work in?
No, I like to ring the changes. People have often accused me of changing my style, which I haven't really done. I suppose superficially I may have done, but ever since I was an infant, I've had an absolute horror of being bored. And so I paint, and if I begin to even get the slightest bit bored with painting, I just paint it again, or paint another thing, or I change in that way, because it's got to be an excitement. It's the only way in which a painting can really transfer its excitement to other people, is the degree of excitement that the artist has expressed, has enjoyed whilst making it.
What were some of your earlier influences?
My earliest influence, I suppose, was my father and mother. When I was, I suppose, about four, they put framed a reproduction of Giorgione's Castelfranco Madonna, and that was put on the wall by my bed, and I absolutely loved it as a painting. And one of the most exciting things that happened. It didn't happen until 10 years ago. We went to Italy, and I went to Castelfranco for the first time and saw the original. And that, I suppose, that painting, that and Giorgione's Tempest, were the earliest of all influences on my work.
Did you have any particular techniques when you first started to paint or draw?
No, I was always trying to find the best way to do what I wanted to do.
To express yourself.
Yes, and to to express what I wanted to express. And I learned so much from the old masters, and it wasn't until much later that, especially when I went to France, I began to really learn from certain modern painters. And I greatly value what I did learn there. Our life in France was fairly hard, but it was immensely rewarding.
So there was never any possibility that you may have chosen another career? It was always...
No, I've always loved writing, but as I say, I write in the winter when it's too dark at night. I hate the idea of it getting dark at 3:30. And I have to keep occupied. I'm absolutely lost if I've nothing to do. And so I write, and I've been writing my memoirs for the last 12 years. But I do it at night, and I do it at night in the winter on my word processor.
Can you give me some idea of what it was like to be an art student in the 1930s?
Oh, it was rather, it's quite different to what it is nowadays, I believe. It was much more disciplined, of course, and the whole, I think art schools, as I said, I think they are a very bad thing, because they, in those days, it was too rigid. I remember at the Royal Academy schools, for the first year, I wasn't allowed to touch paint, not oil paint. I had to draw, and to begin with, I had to draw from the cast. I wasn't even allowed to draw from live models. I had to draw from casts. And the discipline was very strict. Then when I left the Royal Academy schools, I became a pupil of Sir Gerald Kelly, who subsequently became president of the Royal Academy. And the discipline in his studio was absolutely terrifying. But it did me a lot of good. I remember I used to have to work for him from 9 o'clock in the morning until 6 o'clock at night, when I was supposed to finish. But at that moment I had to wash all the brushes that we both used throughout the day. And sometimes there might be 150 brushes, each one of which had to be washed with soap and water individually, and then rinsed in cold water and put in pots on the top of the heating stove in the studio. And I was busy doing this, and about 7:30 I was still washing these brushes. And dear Gerald, because I became quite fond of him subsequently. And he came out of the dining room, down into the studio, took one of the brushes out of the pot, smelt it, and then with his arm he brushed the whole lot into the coal bin beside and said, "They're filthy, wash them all again." And that kind of discipline, I have never heard of anything like that since the war. And since the war, I taught at St. Martin's School of Art from 1949 to 1956. And I was, I suppose, probably one of the last people who actually was taught life painting. And I did try and bring a certain amount of excitement into it for the pupils, but I still kept a decent craftsman-like discipline going as best I could. But nowadays, I'm told that art schools, they don't teach life drawing, they don't teach painting, and I'm not sure they're not butchery classes. Cut cows in half.
So how did you live? What was your daily routine? How would that work in the 1930s?
Oh, my daily routine hasn't changed ever since then. I mean, it's exactly as it is now. I get up very early. I've always liked getting up early. I get up about between 6 and 7 in the summer. And then I work, I breakfast, and I work throughout the day. Or in those days, I used to go off to the art school or to Kelly. And then I come back in the evening and have supper and probably a glass or two of wine, and then go to bed early, and then off again in the morning. I mean, my life is a fairly disciplined life, especially now. I've had very wild moments. I've had moments when, in France, when we were living in France, I had this black period, and I was drinking very heavily and painting at night, and painting strange, dark, broody pictures. But lasted a couple of years, and then I got bored of that and went out and changed back into the light again.
Yeah, I'm trying to get an idea of what your contemporaries, what were their influences, and did they have any political leanings towards?
Tumblies, you see, and I've always been a tremendous, I've been a lone wolf. And if I look back onto those days, there was sort of vague, I suppose there was a vague sort of left-wing tendency in the thought. And sometimes, yes, I said before the war, some people used to think about the fascists, others used to think about the communists. I remember going to Victoria Station to welcome back the wounded soldiers from the Spanish Civil War, which marked us all to a great extent, but we didn't really know that the war was coming until it actually came. Because we've all, see what, I think the real big difference between now and then, irrespective of age, is before the war, life was innocent. And there was a curious innocence about things, in everything, in the media, and just generally in life. There was an innocence. But when I think that there were probably only half the number of people alive in the world in those days to what there are now, I suppose that's partly responsible. But there was an innocence. There was an innocence in every way, as far as I remember. I say, I really was in such a deep sort of dotty kind of dream. It took the war to wake me up, which it did.
How did you hear about the outbreak of war?
Now, how did I hear about the outbreak of war? Oh, I remember, yes. I was up in Scotland, staying with my parents, and there was this talk about how Neville Chamberlain was going to give this pronouncement in the afternoon. And I can remember my father and mother and my brothers and myself clustered around the wireless and hearing Chamberlain's speech saying, from such and such an hour, whatever it was, we are now at war with Germany. And then, of course, one felt a bit sort of frightened because I'd had so many tales from uncles and friends of my parents about the horrors of the First World War. My father, in many ways, was lucky. He was in the Royal Engineers and in the cartographic department. So he didn't actually have he had a fairly hard war, but it wasn't a cruel war to him. But some of my other, and I lost a number of relatives, and the terrible tales that I heard about the trenches, the rats and the poison gas and all these things, one felt fairly apprehensive in September of 1939.
Yeah, how long did you think it would last?
I couldn't see it ever ending.
And after the outbreak of war, did you join up immediately?
Oh, yes. I signed on in September. Immediately one was supposed to. I was 22, I think, at the time. And in one way, of course, I've always had a very adventurous spirit. In one way, I was looking forward to it immensely because it would mean a certain kind of freedom and an excitement in life. Excuse me.
You were just saying about having an adventurous
spirit. Yes, I've always had an adventurous streak in my nature. And somehow the idea of going off to war was a sort of an excitement. You know, I'd read an awful lot of tales about King Arthur and his knights and all that sort of thing. And so I went off. I was actually I was put in the Royal Artillery and as a gunner, and I went off to Devizes, where I had my training, which I enjoyed very much. Far from being the sort of awful monsters that I had thought that sergeant majors and people like that would be, they all turned out to be absolutely delightful people. And I became very happy very quickly. And then when my training was finished, I was posted to a heavy anti-aircraft regiment, which number I can't remember now. That it was nice. We had awful times in it because it was during the Battle of Britain, and the battles all over the place. I started off the winter of 1940. We were at a place called Amesbury, which is now the junction of the M5 and the M4. But we were out on a gun site there, and it was pouring with rain. We had these big guns, and defending the Havilland aircraft factory. But the conditions were pretty ghastly, because of the rain, and especially I was in charge of the predictor, and my little crew of 1, 2, 3, 4 others. Being the predictor, being in a hole in the ground, it filled with water, and it got so just mud and filth. But it was all to a good cause, and all quite exciting, really. And then we went to Woking. And Weybridge, and we had a gun site there, and I remember the sight of the northeastern horizon, just a mass of flames, London burning. But again, there it was, and then that came to an end, and I went off to Shrivenham to the OTC there, and as a cadet, which was very good fun. Shrivenham in those days was absolutely delightful. I came out second out of 2,000 cadets, so I was quite pleased with myself.
What was Shrivenham?
Shrivenham was the Royal Artillery Officer Cadet Training Establishment, just outside Swindon. And I've always been rather passionately fond of mathematics. And the predictor was my great joy in those days. And then when I was commissioned, I had actually looked forward to being sent out to the desert. But I was posted to a City of London regiment, City of London, heavy anti-aircraft, 52nd Heavy Anti-Aircraft City of London regiment, stationed at Barking, where we had the real brunt of the Blitz. I mean, goodness me, we had 8 of these huge, great 4-5 guns. And, I mean, sometimes it would go on all night, all day, all night again. And one used to get pretty tired at times, even young as one was. But then one night I remember going, well, one morning, going off duty, and there'd been an oil bomb had dropped, which was, in those days, was a big bomb. And it had dropped on a block of flats just 100 or 150 yards away from the gun site. And walking back to my billet at 6 o'clock in the morning, there was bits of bodies lying around and furniture and, you know, just things. And it made one feel curiously detached from life, in a way. And I looked upon it as a sort of dream, in a way, an awful dream. Then we went off, the regiment was sent off to Wales to go into, be ready for going abroad. And we had all sorts of training out there. Almost a sort of commando training, in a way. It was,
what did that consist of?
Well, it consisted of a great deal of rough exercises out in the Welsh hills. Not the Brecon Beacons. We were further north. We were out at a place called Tonfanai, which is near Tawin. And we were doing a lot of firing practice out at these drogues, which were drawn across the sky. We had to fire at those, and then, I say, we did a lot of exercises all around. Wonderful scenery. I remember marvelous scenery around Bird Rock, places like that. And it was tough, but it was exciting. And
When would this have been?
This would be 1941.